Call the meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. And first order of business, and we do have a quorum, just in case somebody was wondering. I'd like to have a motion to approve the minutes from January 27th. Representative Vogel?
Chair, I move.
Any comments, corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And opposed? Minutes are approved. We have today a number of presenters and a report that's in front of all of our members. It's in your packet. And we'd like to begin. I'm not sure who is first up, but please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Norris, my name is Scott Olson. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs at the Minsky System, and I'm being joined by Craig Schoenecker, who's our Director of Research. We've also got our colleagues Peter Radcliffe and John Kellogg from the University of Minnesota, and they'll join us to answer questions, and we might be joined by Kent Pickell a little bit later. He's the Executive Director of a College Readiness Consortium. Chair Norris, you should have in your packet this, and you should also have in your packet the report itself. The PowerPoints are what you'll see up here on the screen, and it's a distillation of what's in there. But thank you for the opportunity to come here and talk to you today, and thank you for your service to Minnesota, all of you. Appreciate your interest in our students. So is it okay to
go ahead?
Jump right in? Okay. Please ask any questions as we go. We'll entertain them as we go through it. First is the question of who does this Getting Prepared report cover? The two public systems in Minnesota, the University of Minnesota and MinSCU, report this data back to the school districts. So the superintendents get this report from us about how their students did. And it's a summary that is also sent to the State Department of Ed. Each district gets a detailed report about its own district. It includes public high school graduates who go on to study at public universities or colleges in Minnesota, and measures those who took remedial education within a couple of years after high school graduation. So again, these would be public high school grads going either to the U of M or to MinSCU and who took remedial developmental within a couple of years of arriving there. So who's not in the report would be somebody who graduated from Blake or somebody who went to Carleton or somebody who came to the U from Chicago or somebody who went back after 10 or 15 years of not being in college and went back at that time. So it's really recent high school grads from public schools going into public higher ed. That's who's included. And in there you have the extent and content of developmental and the academic performance of the students. The next chart shows how participation rates are going in higher ed. This is the number of public high school grads who enroll in public higher education in Minnesota from the year 2000 until 2008, which was the last year of our study. What you'll notice is that the percentage of high school grads who are participating in higher education has increased. We've gone from about 46% of our high school public high school grads going to public college or university to about 53% in 2008. I would expect it even went up higher in the last couple of years. You'll notice that the share of those students that goes to the University of Minnesota, that would be the top part of the bar, the share that goes to the U has essentially not changed in that amount of time. They're serving who they serve. They're at capacity. That's who they're serving. The number who are going to the college, state U's has gone up a little bit, but really where you're seeing the growth is in the public colleges, the state colleges. And there you've seen a growth of 27% of our high school grads going to the state colleges to 35%. And this will be important later because what you're seeing is increasing participation in higher ed. And what we'll loop back to later is, you know, thinking about, okay, who would that be? Who is it that wasn't participating in higher ed before and now they are? But we'll come back to that a little bit later. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Craig, who will talk actually about the remedial and developmental results.
Welcome, and identify yourself for the record also.
For the record, my name is Craig Schoenecker, System Director for Research with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. This graphic illustrates, of that population that Scott just described, what percentage of those students are taking one or more remedial or developmental courses within 2 years after graduating. And the solid blue bars represent the average for all of these high school graduates. So we've gone from a little over a third that were taking developmental courses back in the This would be the class of 2000, the students who graduated from high school in 2000. About 34% took developmental courses. Rolling forward to 2008 graduates, we're at 40% of those students taking one or more developmental courses within the first 2 years. And the lines represent the percentage of students going into each system who took developmental courses. So that bottom black line is students going to the University of Minnesota, and here we've gone from 15% taking developmental courses back in 2000 to they're down to 2% of those students coming into the University of Minnesota who took developmental courses for the most recent group. The middle line represents the students going into the state universities, and there we've seen somewhat more stability, a little bit of an increase initially, but 23% for the class of 2000, we're at 22% for the class of 2008. Where you see the growth is the students going into the state colleges. That's represented by the top line on the graph. And here we've gone from 44% of those students taking developmental courses up to 54% for the class of 2008. This graphic illustrates, looks at those students that took one or more developmental courses, but many of them are only taking one developmental course. And so the bars represent the percent of students who took developmental courses that took only one course. So for example, the red bar represents the average for all students. Back for the class of 2000, 56% of those students took only one developmental course. That's gone down a bit statewide to 47% for the class of 2008. But you can see the patterns within the sectors are much different. The green bars represent the state universities, where we've seen a little bit of a decline from 91% to 84% taking one developmental course. The blue bar representing the University of Minnesota indicates that we're now up to 98% of the students that take developmental courses at the university. They're taking only one course. And then at the state colleges, that's where we see the pattern a little bit different. A declining percent of the students taking one course, down from 47% for the class of 2000 to 41% for the most recent class of 2008.
We can stop for a moment. I have a question from Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can read that two ways, and I guess what I want to do is just get a clarification in that percent of graduates taking developmental courses that took one course, that could be read either greater than or less than. So I took one or less, or maybe they took two or three. Can you clarify that?
Sure. The students represented by these graphics are students who took one, they took a developmental course, but it was only one course. So this is the subset of all graduates okay. that took some developmental ed, and then of those, what proportion took only one?
Continue, I guess.
This graphic illustrates the types of courses that the students are taking. Again, it's of the courses taken by all of these students, what percentage of those were in the various disciplines. Red representing mathematics, the yellow segment writing, and the green segment reading, developmental reading courses. You can see at the state universities and at the University of Minnesota, the vast majority of this course taking is in mathematics. At the colleges, it's a little under half. About 47% of the courses that students are taking are in mathematics. Significant percentage there, 24%, are taking a developmental writing course, and also 23% taking a developmental reading course. This graphic illustrates developmental education within the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system. We look at all of our full-year equivalent enrollment in the pie chart. Fully 93-94% of that is college level, undergraduate or graduate level full year equivalent enrollment. So we've got about 6% of our FYE within the MinSCU system is in developmental courses. Those are the two slices, the yellow and red slice. The red slice, about 2% of our full year equivalent is developmental courses that were taken by these recent high school graduates. So about a third of our developmental ed is for recent high school graduates. The other two-thirds would be adults, older students who are taking developmental courses. And to try to give you some context about this segment of our instructional activity, we estimate that a little under $12 million was spent in fiscal year 2009 for those developmental courses that were taken by recent high school graduates. And that's under 2% of our total direct instructional spending of about $627 million in that year. And the students taking these courses would be paying tuition per credit typically, and so they would have paid approximately half of that cost of offering these developmental courses. This graphic is from a different data source, but it's intended to give you some context on the readiness of students coming into higher ed.
Before we get to that slide, Representative Detmer has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any graphics that would indicate, like a course of study, which courses of study might a group of students having to take developmental courses?
Chair Nornes, Representative Detmer, we don't have any graphics on that. That's information that we could certainly provide.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yeah, I'd like to see, you know, what occupations or careers that students are going into that might require them to take, different courses.
Chair Nornes, in general, Representative Detmer, I would expect that students taking degree programs, associate degrees, bachelor degree programs, are going to be more likely to be taking developmental courses, or students coming, for example, a one-year certificate or a two-year diploma in a career or technical field are probably less likely to be taking developmental courses.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
All right, as I was indicating, this graphic reports on the college readiness of Minnesota ACT test takers. It's essentially largely going to be students who were seniors in 2010, high school seniors in 2010, who took the ACT. ACT has done some research to correlate the scores on the various components of their college assessment to what they consider to be college readiness. So they've worked with a variety of colleges and universities to be able to determine that a score, for example, of, say, 26 on the math correlates to someone who is very likely ready for college-level mathematics. And so what these bars report on is the percent of Minnesota's ACT test takers who were not ready for college-level courses in each of these disciplines. So, for example, in English, the 2010 ACT test takers, 21% of them were judged based on the ACT research to be not ready to go into a college-level writing course. The comparison, 34% of all ACT test takers across the country were judged to be not ready for a college-level English course.
We have a question, if I can interrupt for a moment, from Representative Bannion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shaniger, I think I know the answer to this, but I don't know I know the answer to this. How do we establish which students are in need of developmental courses? Because you said it's different from this ACT test. I think maybe we should clarify what that is.
Shoniker.
Chair Nornes, Representative Bannion, our colleges use, the state colleges use AccuPlacer, which is a college board product for testing for course placement. And across the system, we have a standard set of scores that are used to distinguish between somebody who's ready for college level, someone who needs to take developmental courses. Some of the state universities are using some of the components of AccuPlacer, but more commonly the state universities are using the ACT assessment scores to determine who is ready to go into college level courses versus developmental.
Representative Bannick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so I didn't know. I knew we used AccuPlacer at the two-year schools, but there's actually a different means by which we're putting people into developmental courses in the colleges versus the universities. I want to make sure I've understood that.
That's correct. Chair Nornes, Representative Bannion, that's correct.
Oh, okay. If I may continue with this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shaniger, if we get a measure of the students who go through this developmental program in terms of what their success is, I realize your 2008 cohort, you don't have enough time to have measured that, but for some of the earlier cohorts, do we know anything yet?
Chair Nornes, Representative Bannion, Indeed, our Board of Trustees has identified developmental education as one of its priority goals for this year, and we are doing a fair amount of analysis. Actually have done some presentations to the board on the success, both kind of second fall retention, third spring at the colleges, sixth spring, 6 years after entry for the university students, to determine of those that take developmental courses, how successful are they compared to those that didn't, both for our colleges and for the universities.
If I may continue, please. We can at least figure out something in terms of retention for the year after, 2 years after, and we can have some data on that. I think we should be looking at, you know, basically how do they do? I mean, is it possible even to have information on success in terms of relative GPA? I mean, at an aggregated level, I don't think you're going to harm any of your data privacy concerns.
Chair Notice, Representative Bennion, as a matter of fact, in the green cover report, there is a comparison of GPAs by GPA categories for students that took developmental courses versus those recent high school graduates who did not take developmental courses.
Does everyone know where to find it?
Let me find the page
is it
reference.
Table three?
Yes, table three. Page 19 of the report.
Chair Nornis, Representative Bennion, Scott Olson again. We could, the data that you were asking about, Representative Bennion, we could certainly share that with Chair Nornis, and if that's of use to you. We don't have it with us today, but we could share it with him at a future time.
If I could just comment, I'm just going to make a comment to close this thought, is that we're making a substantial investment. There's about, based on what I can tell, the net between the tuition and what your expenditures are basically accounted for largely by state dollars to compensate for that. And I think what we want to know is what's the return on that investment? Are we in fact getting good bang for our development dollar here? And I'm hoping that the data you can provide can give us that. So I look forward to seeing that information. Thank you, Chair.
Go ahead and resume.
Okay. Just a couple more comments on this graphic. So, for example, just talk about mathematics specifically. Of those ACT test takers, 40% were not ready to go into a college-level mathematics course. The comparable figure for the U.S. would be 57%. And you can see those comparisons across the board. The other important point about the ACT data is these are ACT test takers. Most of the students that come to our state colleges do not take the ACT test, so this is not going to be, it's really not exactly the same population, but it gives you some sense of the level of readiness of those ACT test takers. I'm going to turn it back over to Scott Olson.
Representative Nornis, some comments just in general about this. One, you'll notice that the need for remediation varies by the mission of the institution. President Brunix of the University of Minnesota had said some time ago that they wanted to become a more selective institution, and you're seeing that because only 1% of their students now need remedial. That's exactly what they wanted to do. That's where they're going. That's mission appropriate for them. The state university's in the middle a bit. The colleges, which our board have said will have an access and opportunity mission, have been a little more generous in who they admit, and as a result, there's more need for remediation. So it varies by institutional mission. Second point, one of the things that's likely a factor, you noticed in an earlier chart that the percentage of participation in our state colleges has gone up. At the same time, the percentage of need for remediation at the state colleges has gone up. Those things probably correlate. There are students who are going to higher ed now who maybe would never have gone in the past, but maybe have needs that they didn't have in the past. So I think there's a connection there. Third, and this was partially answered in response to Representative Bannion's question, Chair Nornis, but there is a standard across the colleges, a standard placement tool to make sure that you're placed the same regardless of which college. It does make some sense for the state U's to use the ACT because students have to take the ACT to go to the state U's. To take the ACCUPLACER would be an additional cost. So there's some logic to it, to using the ACT there. And obviously math is the biggest issue, so there is a big issue with math. Now, we just wanted a couple slides on what is going on in the state to try to address this. I know this is something big on your minds, and as Dr. Schoenecker said, our Board of Trustees are very concerned about remedial and developmental ed and have made it a major priority of theirs this year. You may have heard of the P20 partnership. This is usually chaired by the Commissioner of Education, shared with either President Brunix or alternating with Chancellor McCormick. So President of the U, Chancellor of MinSCU, and the Commissioner of Ed chair this group, and they've got a number of initiatives, the College and Career Readiness Initiative, Developing Communications Campaign. One of the big keys to this is communicating expectations back well to K-12 so that it's understood and there's no surprises, so that students don't show up and then are surprised, oh, I didn't know I had to do that. And that's on us. We've got to do a better job of communicating it. Third is encouraging middle and high school students to take more rigorous courses while they're there, strategies that you may be aware of to close the STEM gap, and then something that's new, nicknamed SLEDS, the Statewide Longitudinal Educational Data System. This new system that's just starting to roll out now will allow all of our schools in Minnesota to share data and to do really good school-by-school comparisons. So that's kind of exciting. You've probably heard of the Bush Foundation. Peter Hutchinson has thought that part of the problem was teacher education. So there are some of our, the University of Minnesota, some of the state use, some of the private colleges have partnered with the Bush Foundation to revamp teacher education and get it kind of a very different model. The model is really a more of a clinical model, almost like medical education, where the teachers would be spending more time out in the schools rather than in the college or university classroom. And within MinSCU, a number of things, our access and opportunity centers that are located throughout the state. Colleges doing placement testing in the high schools. A good example of that is Minneapolis Community and Technical College has partnered with the Minneapolis Public School System, and they actually do Accuplacer testing together for Minneapolis public high school students. That's a good example of a partnership to make sure that that relationship is going pretty well. Expanding opportunities for high school students to complete rigorous college courses in high school. This is PSEO, college in the schools, concurrent enrollment, those kinds of things, which are increasingly popular. And articulation of secondary and college career tech ed programs. This is sort of the Perkins initiative to make sure that there's a real seamless transition from high school to college. The U of M is doing some things too, so I'll call. Oh, we've got Kent is here. Okay, so Kent Pickell is going to join us, I think, to talk a little bit about what the U is doing. If that's okay, Representative.
That is correct. That's no problem. Good to see you. Welcome, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kent Pickell. I head up the College Readiness Consortium at the University of Minnesota. I am, prior to assuming this position 5 years ago, a K-12 teacher and administrator once and maybe former. 5 years ago, as the university embarked on a transformational process that I'm sure you're very well aware of becoming a more selective institution, it was determined that the university needed to work in partnership with K-12 schools and districts much more aggressively to increase the number and the diversity of students who graduate from high school with the knowledge, skills, and habits for success in higher education. And so, in addition to the sort of broad policy and other efforts that we just talked about previously, we've also been attempting to work with K-12 schools and districts to go deep and really put in place a transformational strategy that individuals, particularly high schools and junior high schools, can use to really flip the switch on the fact that our K-12 system was never designed to get all kids college ready. Historically, it was designed to get about 25 to 30% of the students ready for college and others for some form of post-secondary education or directly into the workplace. And so through a year-long leadership program for school principals, the Minnesota Principals Academy, which we've been very pleased to have state support for at key points over the last 5 years, we've trained over 200 high school or K-12 principals and charter school directors in a research-based approach to school improvement, school designs that put all kids on the path to some form of higher education. And we're right now in the pilot phase of a new junior and senior high school program called Ramp Up to Readiness, all of which we can talk about now or at a later date if you're interested. The key message, I think, is that as somebody who has spent his career in the K-12 realm, K-12 education can't get at this issue in isolation. those of us who are working with kids starting in kindergarten, but all the way up through high school, need to have higher education very aggressively at the table to begin to get the signals right and to align the systems, because we know our kids want to go. In survey after survey, we find that students and their families aspire to some form of higher education, and yet we see these problematic results when they get there. So thank you for the opportunity to give you a very brief snapshot of what we're doing.
Thank you. Any questions from the members? All right. Oh, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I apologize. I was a little late coming in, but I certainly appreciate the collaboration between the Minsky system and the University of Minnesota. I'm wondering about on the teacher training, teacher education piece, since certainly the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is interested in alternative teacher licensure and pathway to being a teacher, how that figures into the work that's being done through Minsky and the university.
Who wants to take that question? Mr. Pickell?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will say the university as a whole has not taken a position on alternative licensure. The university participates in alternative licensure programs as they currently exist, which is to say, the example lots of us use is if an engineer from 3M wants to teach, there are programs that he or she could go through at the university at present. The alternative routes that I think you're speaking of, well, that I know you're speaking of, that the Chamber and others have been interested in bringing to Minnesota, open the possibility of getting a credential without going to any institution of higher education, so through a nonprofit or some other route, or through a higher ed institution but dramatically streamlined, so that it's a much faster process where that engineer, for instance, doesn't need to go through more than a year of preparation. The university as an entity hasn't taken a position on alternative licensure. Individual faculty members, as I'm sure you can imagine, have strong opinions one way or the other on that issue. We've said to at least the previous commissioner and governor that should that be an agenda item for the state, we're happy to work. We're eager to work on research-based ways to show that any alternative licensure approach is not any lessening of the expectations for high-quality teaching. There are ways that we can think about doing that in terms of performance assessments for teachers, some of which we're working on through the Bush Foundation project. So I know that offer stands to be a part of the dialogue. It's not something that at least to date has been part of at least the university's strategy for transforming teacher preparation. Candidly, we're working to redesign our own programming as it exists today.
Mr. Olson.
Chair Norris and Representative Poppy, I think that's descriptive of where Minsky stands too.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Poppy.
Just to follow up then, are you prepared to do that in the next month? I mean, my understanding is teacher licensure, the alternative pathway is something that's, you know, sort of moving along pretty quickly here, and we have not had the opportunity to hear about it actually in higher ed. We haven't done that in the past, and not sure what the plan is for this current situation, but it is something that's happening, and I'm just curious if you're on board enough with it or not. It sounds like you're a little cautious about it and saying that you might want to work with the Chamber and others, but I'm still a bit unclear. It sounds as though it's not been thoroughly vetted through the institutions of higher education where it maybe should be.
Mr. Pickell?
Chair Nornes and Representative Poppy, I want to make sure I'm pronouncing your name correct. Am I doing okay? I hesitated the first time, because nobody gets Pickell right, actually. And so, let me suggest that you accurately diagnosed my hesitance to wade into this issue, but not because, for lack of any sense, that it's very, very important. There has not been, at least in my discussions, both with President Brunix or the dean in our College of Education or others, a specific request for the university's involvement in alternative licensure design. Were such a request to be forthcoming, I know there's a lot of expertise at the university that we might be able to bring to bear to help think about that issue. But to be a little clearer, this hasn't been a dialogue, at least to date, that has very directly engaged the university in how Minnesota might design that. It's been a discussion about Teach for America and a series of other alternatives. Now, certainly, I think something like a quarter of the graduating class in the last few years at the U has applied for Teach for America, so it's not as though that world is disconnected. But there hasn't been a very specific way that they've asked for our involvement in how you might create that at this point. doesn't mean it wouldn't be something that we could consider going forward.
And would Minsku have a comment regarding that, since you actually do have colleges of education, perhaps, in most of your state universities?
Mr. Olson?
Chair Nornison, Representative Poppe, I know the deans of education are watching closely all the discussions about alternative licensure and are very engaged in the Bush initiative, too, and I don't think they've got a position, and I think they're probably waiting to see kind of what's expected of them.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Pop.
Maybe it's more of a comment than a question, but I often, before I was in the legislature, would hear about how the legislature did this to us, made us do these things. It appears as though, I'm not sure if there's going to be a request, I'm not sure, obviously it hasn't come through yet, there's not going to be an ask from the legislature to the higher ed systems, so it's a little bit of, you'll get what's coming to you because it's going to happen. So are you going to be prepared and able to handle that? And again, with the colleges of education, perhaps that may mean some elimination as we're looking at future cost reductions. Does that mean that we'll eliminate a college of education perhaps at St. Cloud or some of the other state universities?
Are you directing it at any specific person?
Not necessarily, okay. But I guess I'm just, you know, I'm concerned about higher education and how we are educating, and I've heard, I think it's, I don't know, 60, 70, 80% of the teachers are educated through, especially maybe the Minsku system. They're proud of that fact, and they want to continue to do that. New pathways may alter that.
Chair Nornis, Representative Poppe, this is a, just candidly, this is a very interesting question you're posing, and I'm thinking, why is my answer so unclear in some respects? I think part of it is that a lot of this in Minnesota took on heat during the race to the top discussion, which happened last year. One of the areas in which Minnesota did not get points was you literally had to have a route to alternative teacher licensure that didn't touch a higher ed institution. That explicitly, there were explicit points for that. It was the absence of that, which Minnesota in its application did not get, that has generated a lot of this discussion, that Minnesota needs a route outside Minsku, the U, or the private colleges. Now, we could have a really interesting, robust debate about whether that's a good idea or not. But I think maybe that's an explanation of why, to some extent, we haven't been directly a part of that discussion, because the whole discussion was, should there be a pathway into teaching that does not require a student, whether they're an engineer in their 50s or a 22-year-old graduate of one of our colleges or universities, to go through higher education. So that's kind of why I think this is a very fluid and interesting question that you're raising. I'll certainly take it back, and I'll talk with President Brunix and Dean Quam and others who more directly are engaged in some of these issues. But I don't hesitate to say that should the expertise of at least the university be something that the state was interested in tapping as it thinks about alternative licensure, I'm sure that we'd be eager to bring to bear research and practice information as we think about that possibility.
All right. Representative Bannion, you have a question?
Thank you. I actually have two, Chairman Norris, and one I should have asked you. One I should have asked you before, Mr. Shenaker. Math ready means different things to different people. What does it mean in this case, and in particular, has it changed over the last 10 years? Does math readiness now mean something different than what it meant 10, 15 years ago?
Mr. Shoenaker.
Chair Nornis, Representative Bannion. I don't know that it's changed. I suppose the fact that we have implemented a common score on a common test means we could have had some changes in students placing into developmental or college level in mathematics. But the other important part of math readiness would be the particular program the student is going into. It might be that there isn't a requirement for college mathematics in many of the certificate diploma programs. And so that student might, if they were going to take mathematics, need to take a developmental math course. But if there's not a college math requirement in the program, they may end up not taking the developmental math course.
Okay.
Representative Vanian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in different schools, it could mean, I mean, just be clear, it could, in a university, it might mean something significantly different than for the folks that go to a college, to a public college, and choose a program that doesn't have, I'm not going to name names. I mean, I'll take culinary arts. Let's just take, you know, all right, that's one that probably you don't need college algebra to be a cook. Okay, so I mean, we could be talking about different standards in different places. Do I have that right?
Mr. Joniker.
Chair Nornes, Representative Banyan, I think the distinction I'd want to make is for a given student with the same program, we would expect that our standard across the colleges is the same for that student.
Oh, okay.
But to the extent a student has a different degree objective, then there would be potentially a different
sure.
expectation applied.
Sure, that's fair. Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, if I could then do my second question, which is more broadly directed to the group of you, in fact. So we have this nice report, and I think this has got some interesting results and includes a lot of information specific to high schools and specific to school districts. And I would imagine you've delivered this to those high schools and school districts. What happens now? What happens this report? Is someone going to? What do the school districts and the schools that you've spoken to? You won't be able to speak for all of them, but just in general, what are you hearing? How they're going to respond to this?
Mr. Olson,
Chair Nornes and Representative Banyan. I know my colleague Kent Bickell will have a lot to say about the passion with which this is used in some districts. It does vary. We find some superintendents really wait for it, use it thoroughly, and others perhaps just note its passing. There's a lot in there. It's rich. We actually, in the past, were able to share a little more data than we are currently. But in fact, well, I'll turn it over to, if I may, to Mr. Bickell, because he'll tell you some stories about back when he used to receive the report.
Mr. Bickell?
Chair Nornes, Representative Banyan. When I was in St. Paul schools, we did exactly what you're alluding to. It was actually back when I remember the first time this came, you didn't even get a data file. We literally, boxes came to the superintendent's office with paper files of individual kid transcripts. This was six iterations ago. And this was a time when we were working very hard to reduce dropout rates and raise graduation rates. And as soon as we literally opened these boxes, came from state colleges and universities for the first time, it was like a gold mine, because suddenly these were our kids, and we all were flying blind. Mm-hmm. None of us, I was a high school teacher, you get a self-report of where the kid thinks they're going the following fall, but you don't get hard data. That's why this larger data system piece is going to be so important and powerful for you to be engaged in. So what did we do? You asked about mathematics a moment ago, and it's a very important question. We know that for a four-year degree, math is the best predictor of your ability to finish the degree. And we know that the tipping point to finishing a degree, this is national data now, is Algebra 2 or above. For every step you take, a kid takes above Algebra 2, their chance of earning a BA doubles in the traditional math sequence. So what we did in St. Paul was we literally, with those first boxes, and then we updated it when we started to get electronic files, we looked at the courses our kids were taking, and we discovered we had a ton of kids who were not succeeding in the equivalent of Algebra 1. And we increased course taking in Algebra 1. We worked very hard to align the content, and then we did the same with what we called Algebra 2. And so the first piece is what courses are you offering, how many kids are taking them, and then the second piece, though, is what supports are you giving to kids who aren't succeeding in those courses. One of the things we found is that some kids needed a double period of mathematics. You can imagine they cheered gleefully when they got that. But I'll tell you why this data is fundamentally different than in much of the data, for instance, we get from No Child Left Behind and others. You can think what you want about that kind of data. I think it's often still very powerful and useful. But these are your kids in college at St. Cloud State, at the U. This is very human data. And I don't know any teacher that doesn't look at this data and say, that's my job. I teach math in this high school. My kids had to take these courses in their higher ed institutions. It's not abstract data from somewhere else in Minnesota or even somewhere nationally. So it's very actionable, powerful data. It needs to be put in context, because a lot of our kids who take that one math course, we only require 3 years of mathematics in Minnesota. So it's very common for a kid to get to the end of 3 years of high school math, say, phew, I'm done with math, take a year off of mathematics, and then they go to one of our institutions, they have two summers and a full year off math, and they look at needing to begin, their math skills are very rusty. And so suddenly, they need to actually take a developmental course. It's one reason why at the university, and the Faculty Senate will be voting on this very soon, only three schools at the university currently require 4 years of mathematics: the Carlson School of Management, the College of Biological Sciences, and the College of Science and Engineering. And we're on the cusp of saying it's 4 years of math for all schools. Now, the vast majority of entering students at the U currently bring that in. But I'll tell you again, as a K-12 practitioner, when the university takes that step, it will have ripple effects in the K-12 system, as people realize you need to have 4 years of mathematics to succeed at the university. And I think our colleagues at Minsky, it's not quite in the same place, but we've been in close conversation about the merits of doing that.
Representative
Chair,
Daniel.
Thank you, Chair Norris. I'm just going to say, you're right. He does have passion for this topic, and Mr. Pakel, I appreciate that very much. Do you see anything that we can do as legislators to encourage that what you just described? Because you said there's a variety of responses that not everybody shares the passion you just shared with us. That's going on in the schools that you had experience with. So, is there anything we can do?
Chair Nornes, Representative Banyan, I would say that there are many things you can do, some of which, just to stick to the point we've made, I think the completion of a longitudinal data system, and critically, SLEDS, yeah, as we've come to call it, making that data understandable to teachers, administrators, admissions professionals, and average citizens, so that it's not just a long spreadsheet no one can read, is critical. The Department of Ed last year received a $12.5 million federal grant to build this system. I would urge you to be working with the Department of Education and the Minnesota Office of Higher Education to be quite involved in the implementation of that system, and candidly to be asked regularly to be updated on its progress. And here's the interesting policy issue. It's really important when you ask about the high schools. A lot of states that have done this, like Florida, where you as a high school principal can push a button and get a great report, don't have their private colleges and universities in the system. Florida may have more now than they did initially. Our private college council has been an integral part of these discussions thus far about a state data system. You know better than I do, they're a different sector. But for a lot of the high schools I work with, they look at this report and they say, but our kids go to the Minnesota private colleges. If in Minnesota we can, addressing the privacy issues that the private colleges understandably have, which are different than us, if we can have them in a Minnesota longitudinal data system so we can really follow kids not just to Mankato or U of M at Crookston, but to St. Kate's or Dunwoody, or, I mean, that's even another realm, it will make our data system really nation-leading. And so that's the one thing that, there are many other things, and I'd love to stay in dialogue with you, but there's $12.5 million in a federal grant that's there. It's a three-year grant. The clock's ticking on it, and I think having it be part of this committee's ongoing dialogue with all of us is a very good use of your leadership role.
Mr. Olson.
Chair Nornes and Representative Banyan, the P20 Council, I think, does have a representative of the House on it, so there's a natural way for that communication to flow back and forth.
All right. Representative Atkins, you have a question.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen, I appreciate your presentation. I've got a number of good takeaways from the from what you said. The two questions I had, one is, so I got my eighth grade daughter is just about to finish up Algebra 2. Can she just, you know, cut out the middleman and get her BA directly, saving her dad a whole bunch of money? And the serious question is, what's the correlation? You made a point earlier about very strong correlation between finishing Algebra 2 and finishing college. Is it 90%? Is it 75%? Do you know that off the top of your head? But you did say it's the single most prevalent indicator.
Chair Nornes, Representative Atkins, the study is one that came out of the U.S. Department of Education a number of years ago called First Answers in the Toolbox and the Toolbox Revisited. I'd be glad to get you the actual percentages. I know that when they did the regression analysis, math came out the highest, Algebra 2 came out the best. You're asking for a twist on that data, which is interesting. It mostly compared algebra to not taking it, as opposed to what percent do you have to actually complete. It was the best, but I don't know that percentage off the top of my head. The larger story, of course, those data are predictive. So the kids who take more math are kids who are more academically inclined. The question is it causal? if kids take algebra who wouldn't have otherwise, will they be more college ready? And I'll say, Minnesota, really, we're on the cusp of a huge sea change in our mathematics education in the state, because we're one of only two states, to my knowledge, us in California, that requires Algebra 1 in junior high or middle school and Algebra 2 in high school. And those kids are now, I think, in junior year. I mean, you or your predecessors passed that a number of years ago. The kids are just moving through the system. And so we really are at a fundamental point to see if, frankly, your daughter could have gone on to college right from Algebra 2 in 10th grade. The one thing I'll say from talking about that issue of course taking in high school and college readiness, when I've talked to math faculty, not just at the University of Minnesota, but at the State College and University as well, candidly, solid mastery of Algebra 2 probably is a very good starting point for college algebra. Now, a lot of kids take Algebra 2 in sophomore year of high school or maybe even freshman year. The thing to remember, though, is that implies that they then don't drop mathematics for 2 years. The point is that the image here is academic momentum, that if the kid hits that bar and then doesn't continue, one of the things we'd like to see more students who, for instance, themselves are not interested in mathematics explicitly, we'd love to see high schools put in place more courses that use mathematical knowledge and skills but are not necessarily just math. Statistics is a great example, where students who, frankly, don't want to go on to calculus or pre-calc could get to a certain level in the traditional math sequence and then begin to take other courses that use their math skills, but that might be more interesting to them, might be more applied, might be more hands-on and technically oriented. But the key is that they don't let their math skills get rusty before they hit college.
Mr. Olson.
Chair Nornes and Representative Atkins, I think probably Representative Poppy would know better how to counsel your daughter than I would, but I think the key is that she stay with math, and that's where the college and the schools and PSEO and some of the initiatives that we're doing make a big difference, because sometimes bright students run out of math courses they can take there at their high school, and that's where, you know, Inver Hills or whoever would maybe have other things that somebody could take that would keep them challenged and maybe have them, you know, getting through calc in high school and then really ready to go right into an engineering program or STEM, anything.
Representative Atkins, are you done?
Just a brief, completely different topic to question, but the main takeaway is so Katie Atkins can't quit math after eighth grade anyway. Very pointed, frankly, very political question, following up on what Representative Poppy asked. Has either of the chief authors of the alternative licensing bills been in contact with you to seek you or the people that you represent to seek their advice relative to those bills? Or that bill, I should say.
Mr. Olson.
Chair Nornes and Representative Atkins, not with me personally, but I couldn't say that they weren't in touch with others in our system who may have expertise. I wouldn't know that. If they were in direct contact with one of the deans of education, I may not know that that was happening. But not with me, no.
Mr. Pickell.
Chair Nornes, Representative Atkins, that would be the same. That would be my identical answer. Not to my knowledge. Most things that are K-12 oriented that hit President Brunick's desk, I get pulled into, but it's a big university, and there's a lot of folks who are deeply engaged, and so, in fact, it may have come across that desk or others, and I'm not aware of it. I'll certainly be glad to check, and as I mentioned, I think the issue is, at least for the university, in what way might we add value to that discussion if we add value to that discussion?
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you.
Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You may have already answered this in one way, since the goal, according to all the studies, show that we need to have about 70% of the folks graduating from high school enrolled in some level of post-secondary in the next 10 years. When it comes to evaluating for math, and just stay with math, because you know there are other elements in this, of course, that we need to focus on too. I teach at a small private Christian college, and I have a harder time with how they write, but we'll stick with the math. Is there an assessment tool at the eighth grade, between the eighth and ninth grade, to give folks in high schools a leg up on helping? I mean, if we're going to try to get to 70%, we need to know early on those folks that still need help. Maybe they need pre-algebra in ninth grade just to get them ready for algebra and algebra 2. Is there an assessment tool?
You got it?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, and Representative, I apologize. I know your K-12.
Benson.
I know your K-12 colleagues well, but this is fun for me because it's new. But Representative Benson, we strongly recommend in the work that I do through this program, Ramp Up to Readiness, that students, for exactly the reason you've diagnosed, take this full sequence of tests that ACT offers, and there's three of them: the Explore test, which can be taken in eighth grade, the plan test in 10th grade, and the ACT in 11th. Those two are aligned with the ACT, which is required for admission to university. And interestingly, they give not only data on mathematical understanding, but there's a whole interest inventory and career battery there that if you actually if the kid takes it seriously, is going to get very interesting data on areas of learning style and career aspiration. The other obvious point I'd make, but it's an important one, especially in a state where, depending on how you count it, we have the second worst student-to-counselor ratio in the country. Somebody's got to sit down and talk with the kid and the family about that data. So simply taking the test doesn't shed that light. But the Explore and the Plan tests, we find, can be very powerful tools for doing exactly what you're suggesting, which is to say giving the kid additional support or putting him on an accelerated path.
Mr. Olson.
Chair Nornes, this isn't really an answer to Representative Benson's question, but just to underline something that Representative Benson said. He was referencing that Carnevale study out of Georgetown that says that by the year 2018, 70% of Minnesota workers will have to have some level of post-secondary education, and this is something that's going to require all the work of these two systems, plus the private colleges, plus the for-profits. If you remember this statistic, 53% of the students right now are going on. We're going to need all of them, and lots of workers who are going to have to come back and learn new skills and new tools. And it's a kind of an all hands on deck thing. So I just wanted to express gratitude that that's on your radar screen, because it's going to be a very important thing for this state. It's going to be a great state to live in if we get there, because it'll be a state full of knowledge workers.
Mr. Chairman, one follow up. Since we've talked about the eighth grade and there is some examples of districts using the tool, is there a correlation between what you see as a higher rate of graduation and post-secondary in those districts that use the tools compared to those that don't?
Mr. Schoenecker.
Chair Norris, Representative Benson, I'm not familiar with research that would address that question specifically.
Do you have a question or an answer?
No, I was going to second up. Chair Norris, Representative Benson. Again, it's a very interesting question. I just want to be sure I understand it. Districts that give those tests, do they literally send more kids college ready to higher education? I'm also not aware of the data, but not being a careful and cautious researcher of these numbers, unlike Craig, I'll say my hunch is yes. But I haven't looked at that, so I think it's a very interesting question. Do districts that use that assessment sequence have a higher rate of readiness when they send their kids on? In my informal experience around the state, it's a good marker of a junior or senior high school that's really serious about college readiness if they're using and giving those tests.
Representative Benson.
And might I suggest that maybe some grad student would be looking at some potential study in that area, and that as we move forward to get to that goal of in 2018 hitting 70%, that would be a marker that we'd use to decide.
And thank you.
Representative Morrow, you want to join?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Yes, I was sitting upstairs in my office coughing away and listening, so it's been a fascinating hearing so far. And I know Representative Poppy and Representative Atkins in particular raised some questions about the university and the Minsky system and about the teacher licensure question. And then I wanted to thank Mr. Pickell. You and I have talked by phone about the teacher performance assessment, and I know that we talked about bringing together the University of Minnesota, the Minsky system, the Bush Foundation, and others to talk about the teacher performance assessment process. And so, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to come down to at least invite members. The Misty Sato from the University of Minnesota and Karen Ballmer from the Board of Teaching, they're coming back here tomorrow at 9 o'clock to meet again to talk about the teacher performance assessment. They've testified in the K-12 committee. The former chair of MSU Mankato, Dr. Michael, Mike teach
Chair Nornis, Representative Morrow, are you thinking of Mike Miller?
Mike Miller, yes.
He's the former Dean of Education at Minnesota State University Mankato, which is my home institution.
Has also talked about the TPA, so I was just going to invite members, if they wanted to pursue this discussion more, there will be this meeting tomorrow at 9.
At where?
On the second floor. I'll send out an email with more information.
Okay, that'd be good. Appreciate that. Representative Norton, did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, when I closed our meeting the other day with my comment, this was exactly the presentation I suggested come to this body. So they will be coming to you to request a hearing before you at some point.
I think we've been in communication with them. Yeah. Anyone else? Representative, Mr. Piquel?
Chair Nornis, I prompted by Representative Morrow's statement, I want to be sure I'm speaking clearly. I think I made this point. The University of Minnesota as an institution has neither been, to my knowledge, asked, and I know has not taken a position on either of the alternative licensure bills that are being discussed or on alternative licensure generally. That said, individual faculty members, and you mentioned Dr. Sato and others, are working hard on licensure issues broadly and may have very strong opinions one way or the other. As you know, higher ed is bound to do. So when I'm making this point today, I'm making the point collectively for the University of Minnesota. It hasn't been an issue we've engaged as an institution at this point.
Thank you. Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, this is not for you, but I appreciate your statement that individual faculty members could make a passionate statement one way or another. So this is for the Minsky system. If a state representative who represented a state university, let's see, maybe this one, and requested a position of the College of Education or from the president of the university, would the Minsky system allow either the college or the Department of Education within the college to take a position?
Mr. Olson?
Chair Nornis,
and be careful how you answer, because I've made such a request.
Sure. Chair Nornis, Representative Pulaski, if what you're asking is could an individual on one of those campuses have a position? Yes. Could the dean of a local college have a position? Yes. Could the deans all get together on behalf of MNSCU, use their position as MNSCU's position? No, I don't believe they can. I think that would have to go through our leadership council and go through our board of trustees if it was being presented as an official MNSCU position.
Mr. Chair, you've answered two questions. I only asked one. Okay. The question I asked was, if I made a request of a dean of a college of education on this particular piece of legislation, not as an individual with respect to the First Amendment to the Constitution, but how this legislation would impact the programs within that college of education, could that dean make a public statement as to the impact of this legislation? Not as an individual now, as a dean of that college of education, without going through MNSCU Central.
Mr. Chair Olson?
Chair Nornis, Representative Pulaski, I'm not aware of that request having been made. I'm guessing it has been made, and I'm guessing that someone has been told they couldn't do it. They weren't told by
Mr.
my office.
Mr. Chair, I haven't said that.
Okay.
I'm asking you. So let's not put words in my mouth.
Okay. I'm sorry.
I am asking you because I represent a college. By the way, Winona State University is the first land-grant university west of the Mississippi, and it was formed as a college of teachers. So I ask it because of 150 years of teaching teachers. And I think maybe they should be able to comment on an alternative teacher licensure program. So it's a simple question.
Sure.
Obviously, though, the answer isn't that simple.
Ms. Chair Nornis, Representative Pulaski, I think if the question is, should they be able to make a statement about the impact that this would have on their college, which I think is what you're asking, my opinion is, yes, they should be able to say that. If it's a question of whether they had been allowed to or not, I'm not aware. I don't know if someone's been told they couldn't, but in my opinion, they should be allowed to say, this is how this will impact our college in terms of student success or progress toward licensure or whatever.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your answer, and I think it represents the problem that we have with MNSCU Central, as opposed to the direct problem that we have with legislation and its impact at the college level. Again, I would go back to the college level and find out how legislation impacts students and program, and I would hope I wouldn't have to walk, as I do every day, past Minsky Central and knock on the chancellor's door.
No more questions. I believe there are two others on the list here to testify today.
Chair Nornes, I think you're talking about our colleagues Peter Radcliffe and John Kellogg, who I introduced at the beginning and who deferred to Kent Bakel to speak on behalf of you, but that's who's sitting in the front row over there, and they also helped with the preparation of this report.
Right.
And
I didn't know if they wanted to actually take your seats, but I guess not. Okay. Then I believe we're probably to the end of our discussion. It's been a good one. Appreciate you being here and the report. I just want to encourage members, if you have bills that you're working on, continue to work on them. You can visit with me if you have some questions or with Mike. And with that, we will be adjourned. Thank you.